stood halfway up as if to leave.
Maybe we should give them some privacy.
Then he seemed to realize that the only exit led right into their argument. He sat back down. The only other option would have been to sneak out single file through the cook's entrance, which would be even more awkward, an admission that we were hearing their raging argument. So he sat there listening, wondering how it could get worse. Words like devil's hell, damn fool, and I decide raised eyebrows. But prisoner was a word that sucked in breaths. Tavish groaned, and Jeb mumbled a curse. Sven leaned forward, his face in his hands like he wished he could counsel his charge in the rules of a proper argument. I heard him mumble, "Drag her?" beneath his breath. Grizz was surprisingly silent, and I realized he was enjoying listening to the king dig his grave. Grizz believed in Leah in a strange, fierce way that I was only just grasping. It didn't matter that she planned to leave him behind. The king was showing his true royal colors, and Grizz was savoring every word. I tried to savor the warm kernel of satisfaction growing in my gut, too, but I also knew the rage I heard in Leah's voice came from a place of deep hurt. My satisfaction turned cold. After my promise of honesty, I had dispensed only portions of the truth to Rafe about my kiss with Leah, knowing it would enrage him, but she was the one who had shouldered the brunt of the pain it had caused. I didn't want to hurt her any more. It was quiet outside on the veranda, and Sven finally broke our silence.
What else could he do? It's not safe for her to go back to Morrigan.
She asked me once about going home, Jeb said. I always assumed she meant Dahlbreck.
Dahlbreck is not her home, I told him.
It's going to be, Tavish said, shooting me a dark glare.
Nothing to worry about.
Orin poured himself more ale.
She'll come to her senses.
Tavish snorted. Sure she will.
Her worry is valid, I said. The Komazar is going to march against Morrigan and the other kingdoms.
Which kingdom first? Sven asked.
Morrigan.
And you know that with certainty, probably because he told you.
Sven's point was clear. The Komazar wasn't the best source for any truths, and I knew how he could hold back information, pitting one governor against another for his own purposes. The Komazar wanted Morrigan, but he wanted Dahlbreck too. He wanted them all.
Yes, I answered. Certain.
But now I wasn't. Bodine grinned.
March with his supposed army of 100,000?
Grizz cleared his throat.
Not exactly, he said, finally speaking up. I'm afraid the princess didn't get the numbers quite right.
No, she didn't. I remembered when I returned to the sanctum and asked the Komazar how the plans were going.
Better than I hoped.
His army had grown significantly in the last few months.
Sven's eyes were sharp beads on Grizz, as if he knew there was more coming.
There you go,
Haig said, waving his hand in the air.
Confirmation right out of the big barbarian's mouth. Maybe he's the one who should speak to the princess.
Grizz swilled back a shot of red eye and set the glass down with a loud thud.
The numbers are actually closer to 120,000. All well armed.
He motioned to Sven to pass the bottle to refill his empty glass.
That's about twice the size of your forces, isn't it, Captain?
Jeb sighed.
Three times.
Haig said nothing. His mouth gaped like a fish dangling from a hook. Grizz tried to restrain a smile. Orin and Tavish shook their heads, and Sven passed the bottle to Grizz, scrutinizing him for signs of a lie. It was the truth. That was what the Komazar was so heavily pressuring the governors for. More supplies to sustain his expanding army.
They're only wild barbarians! not a trained marching army. The numbers mean nothing,
Haig finally sputtered, dismissing the matter. Bodine sat back in his chair.
While the size and abilities of a Vendan army remain in question, he interjected, the king's concerns do not. His worry is valid, too. I understand there's a bounty for the princess's capture, and, thanks to the Komazar and his rumors, probably something much worse awaits her by now. I think I heard King Jackson describe her as the most wanted criminal in Morrigan. That's a perilous position to be in.
Stalemate. That was true, too, and I knew in their view it made Grizz and me look callous and unconcerned for Leah's well-being. Bodine quirked his head to the side, listening, and then stood, finally judging it safe to leave.
What was that last thing she growled as she went down the steps? Jabave?
It's a Vendan word for... Sven coughed, cutting me off.
It's not a term of endearment, he offered. The king knows what it means. That's all that matters.
My kernel of satisfaction warmed again, in spite of myself.
It is in the sorrows, in the fear, in the need. That is when the knowing gains wings. The black wings of knowing fluttered beneath my breast. He was gone, and he would not come back. The Lost Words of Morrigan. Chapter 32.
I paced in my tent, trying to control my rage. My blood raced faster than a whipped horse. I was certain that at any moment he would come, his head bowed in shame, begging forgiveness for his appalling behavior. My head throbbed, and I rubbed my temples as I wore a path on the carpet. Come to my senses! Did he even hear himself? Dear gods, had the entire camp heard us? The dining room veranda was far from the soldiers' barracks, but the officers' quarters were within earshot. I squeezed my eyes shut, imagining all the ears pressed to windows. I knew Rafe was under strain, and the additional news today of descent back home only piled on more stress. But I was under pressure, too. I hissed a frustrated breath between clenched teeth. Maybe in some small way I had gone behind his back, but it was only because I wanted to get my intentions out before he returned, making them clear and public and certain so he couldn't discount them the way he had before. Maybe he could construe it as usurping his authority, especially at a time when he was trying to gain the confidence of those around him. But acting like an ass was no way to gain respect. I decide. I was not a subject of Dalbrek. He would decide nothing. Minutes passed, and then an hour with still no sign of him. Was he sulking? Too ashamed to come and apologize? Maybe he was commiserating with his men over his ill-spoken words, or contemplating what Eben had shared. Rafe wasn't stupid. With the Komazar alive and moving forward with his plans, he had to know we were all at risk. Keeping me alive for now meant nothing if in the end we were all dead or imprisoned. Just because Morrigan was the Komazar's first target didn't mean that Dalbrek wouldn't be next. I grabbed a pillow from my bed and punched it, then threw it against the headboard. Sword play! I could still hear his sarcastic emphasis on play. Maybe that was what hurt most of all. His lack of belief in me, only valuing his kind of strength and not the kind I possessed. The kind that had helped save both of our necks. Caden had earned a healthy knot on his shin when he had done the same. It wasn't too late for me to give Rafe a knot, too. Maybe he needed one on his head. The sides of the tent shivered with the wind, and a low, distant rumble sounded as if the skies had been drawn into our tempest. I added wood chips to the stove. Where was he? I threw aside the curtain of the tent entrance. Two guards stepped forward to block my path, crossing their halberds in front of me. "Please, Your Highness, step back inside," one of them asked. A wrinkle curled across his brow. He looked genuinely frightened. "I really don't want to..." He was unwilling to finish his thought. "Drag me back to my quarters, as the king ordered." He nodded. The other guard fretted with the shaft of his halberd, refusing to meet my gaze. Surely they'd never had to guard a prisoner like me before, one who had been a guest of the king only hours before. For their sakes alone, I stepped back and snatched the curtain closed, growling as I did. I snuffed the chandelier lights, and the room glowed dimly with the embers from the stove. I seethed that he hadn't already come in here begging on bended knee. I flopped onto my bed, taking off one boot, then another, then threw them across the room. Both smacked the tent wall, each small thud pathetically unsatisfying. Anger stabbed in my throat like a painful bone I couldn't swallow. I didn't want to go to sleep this way. I brushed at my wet lashes, blinking away tears. Maybe I should have explained it to him in private. Could I have made him understand? But I thought of all our miles traveling from the sanctum to here, all the times he had skillfully turned the conversation away from Morrigan. We just have to reach the outpost for now. He had done it time and time again, so smoothly I hadn't even noticed. Tonight he hadn't bothered to be smooth. All I got from him was a curt, arrogant dismissal. No. No chance for discussion, Leah. I jumped up from my bed, sucking in a startled breath. It was his voice, just on the other side of the curtain, low and quiet, contrite. I knew he'd come to work this out. I walked to the end of the bed, quickly wiping my face with my palms. I pressed my back against the wide bedpost column and took a deep, cleansing breath. "Come in," I said softly. The curtain parted, and he stepped inside. My stomach twisted. Only 2 hours had separated us, but it had felt as long as my trek across the entire Camlan Tow. The dark crystal pools of his eyes warmed my blood in a way that made me feel lost to everything else in the world but him. His hair was tousled, as if he'd been out for a brisk ride to work off his pent-up frustrations. His face was calm now, his eyes soft, and I was sure a well-practiced apology waited on his lips. He searched my face, his gaze tender.
"I just wanted to check on you," he said quietly. "Make sure you had everything you needed."
"Now that I'm a prisoner?" Hurt flashed in his expression.
"You're not a prisoner. You're free to move about the camp."
"As long as I don't leave." He stepped closer, stopping only inches away. The heat of his body surrounded me, filled the tent, filled my head.
"I don't want it to be this way between us," he whispered.
He reached out and touched my hand. His fingers slowly slid up my arm to my shoulder, and his thumb traced a slow, lazy circle over my collarbone. Hot embers burned in my chest. He knew I wanted him, that I wanted nothing more than to reach out and close the hurtful space between us. Almost nothing more. "Are you here to apologize?" I asked. His hand slipped behind my back, drawing me closer, his hips meeting mine, and his lips brushed my earlobe.
"I have to do what I think is best. I can't let you go, Leah. Not in good conscience. Not when I know the danger you'd be heading into."
He loosened the laces of my dress. My breaths skipped through my chest, uneven, singeing my thoughts. His lips skimmed a burning line from my temple to my mouth, and then he kissed me, hard and deep, and I wanted to melt into the feel and taste and scent of him, the wind in his hair, the salt on his brow. But another need, a greater one, flamed brighter, blazing and persistent. I wedged my hands between us, gently nudging him away. Rafe, haven't you ever felt something deep in your gut, or heard a whisper you had to listen to against all reason? The tenderness receded from his eyes. I am not going to change my decision, Leah, he said. I need you to trust me. You're not going back for now. Maybe later, when it's safer. I stared into his eyes, praying he'd see the urgency in mine. It will never be safer, Rafe. It's only going to get worse. He stepped back, sighing, everything about his stance conveying impatience. And you think you know this because of an ancient text? It is true, Rafe. Every word is true. How do you know? You're not a scholar. You may not have even translated it properly. His boorish skepticism snapped the last of my patience. There would be no more explaining or groveling. We're done. Leah, get out! I yelled, shoving him away. He stumbled back and stared at me, stunned. You're throwing me out? No, I don't think it's possible to throw you out. You are, after all, King Jackson, and you decide who comes and goes here, or so I've been told. But I suggest you leave before I find another way to dispatch you. I placed my hand at my side over my sheathed dagger. Pure rage flushed his face. He turned and stormed off, nearly ripping the curtain from the door. We'd see which of us came to our senses first. Madame Rathbone appeared at my tent early the next morning, along with Viola and Adeline. Curiously, Madame Haig accompanied them, though she never had before. Inwardly I sighed. Yes, the officers and all their wives had heard our ugly argument, and certainly Madame Haig was hoping for additional juicy details, even if the official purpose of their visit was to deliver the accessories to go with my dress for the party that evening. Adeline held up a silver chainmail belt encrusted with sapphires. Once again, I marveled at the extravagance, especially here at this remote outpost. Next, Viola laid out a jeweled silver pauldron, embossed with an intricate pattern. Tell me, have Dalbrecht women ever actually worn these in battle?
Oh, yes, Viola answered. That's why they're part of our traditional dress. Marabella was a great warrior before she was a queen.
But that was hundreds of years ago, Madame Haig added, raising her brows in distaste. Our ladies and queens don't go to battle anymore. It's unnecessary now. Don't be so sure, I was tempted to say. Madame Rathbone took a last inventory of everything laid out on the table and said, We'll be by early to help you dress. And do your hair, Adeline said.
With silver cording,
Viola added, clasping her hands together in anticipation. I heard a strained eagerness in their voices, as if they were trying to erase the dark pall of last night's argument. You'll all be busy getting ready yourselves, I answered. I can manage on my own.
Really? Madame Haig asked doubtfully. Is that how it's done back in Morrigan? No one to attend you?
Her lip lifted with patronizing pity.
Yes, I sighed. We're nothing but savages in Morrigan. It's a wonder your king would arrange a marriage with one of our kind at all.
Her lashes fluttered downward, and she left with a faint apology that she had much to do that day, but with no apology for her insult. Perhaps now that her king had lashed out at me, she felt free to do the same. 6 guards arrived at my tent a short time later. Percy, their leader, informed me they were my escorts for the day. So, this was Rafe's version of being free to go where I wished? 6 guards, even within the walls of Marabella. I supposed I should take it as a compliment that Rafe held my skills in higher regard than he would admit. I immediately decided I had many places I would need to go today, not only so the entire outpost could share in the amusement of 6 guards trotting behind me, but also because, one way or another, I would be leaving, and I needed to attend to details. First, I went to the lower paddock, checking on our Vendon horses, now also in the custody of the king. I eyed the lower gate where horses came and went. It was heavily guarded. We'd never get past that, but at least I knew where the horses and tack were. I'd figure out the rest later. Next, I went to the cook's pantry. The cook was not pleased with my intrusion, saying he would gladly bring something to my tent. I pretended I wasn't sure what I wanted, then perused the shelves and cold cellar. Unfortunately, nearly everything was stored in large, bulky bags or containers. I took one of his bowls and filled it with handfuls of pine nuts, hard soda bread, and some dried sweet figs. He eyed my strange assortment of food and glanced at my abdomen. I smiled sheepishly, letting him draw his own conclusions. Next, I trudged over to the physician's barracks to consult with the surgeon. Caden and Eben were gone to the showers, but the surgeon was in the middle of examining Grizz's wound. He showed me that it was healing nicely in most places, but one section of flesh was slower to knit. He said he felt confident that it would heal, then shot a stern glance at Grizz. "With a little more rest?" Grizz balked, saying he was fine now. "But you won't be if you're lifting heavy saddles on and off a horse twice a day," I said. "Or, the heavens forbid, if you should have to swing your sword." Grizz smiled, his eyes twinkling with mayhem.
"Anywhere you'd like me to swing it in particular?"
My stomach burned. He had heard our argument, too, which meant everyone in the dining room had. Surely Caden gloated over this development. But when I saw him in the workyard later, there was only concern in his eyes. He spoke in Vendon so the guards wouldn't understand us. "You're all right?" he asked. I nodded, trying to ignore the knot swelling in my throat again. He grinned. "And Rafe's shins?" I knew he was trying to lighten my mood, and for that I was grateful. "Fine for now, but this isn't over."
"I never thought it was."
His vote of confidence in me was like cool water on a parched throat. I wanted to hug him, but that would only have brought him additional scrutiny. The guards became nervous with this conversation they couldn't understand, as if they suspected we were conspiring, which we were. I stepped closer to Caden and whispered to really give them something to worry over. "When we leave, Eben will have to stay behind with Grizz. It will just be the two of us, with Malak out there somewhere. Are the odds against us?"
"He'd have been there with the others in the Valley of Giants if he was sent to kill you. I think he's on his way to Civica with a message."
"That I'm dead?"
"That you've escaped. They won't count you as dead until they have a body, and they'll know exactly where you're headed."
Which meant the Chancellor and his co-conspirators would be waiting for me, probably watching every road leading into the city. The element of surprise was no longer mine. I didn't need anything to be harder than it already was. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Tavish and Orin sauntering up to us, shoulder to shoulder. They circled, stopping on either side of me.
"We're here to relieve the guards, Your Highness," Tavish said, casting a withering stare at Caden.
"Off you go, Percy,"
Orin added, with a shooing motion.
"Colonel wants you all back at his office. Go."
Tavish gave a respectful nod toward me.
"We'll be your escorts for the rest of the day."
"By whose orders?" I asked. Tavish smiled.
"Ours."
Neither Tavish nor Orin spoke Vendon, so I quickly spoke a few last Vendon words to Caden. "We'll talk more later. We need to gather supplies." Tavish cleared his throat.
"And Jeb will be joining us shortly."
His message was clear. Jeb spoke Vendon. I sighed. This was more than loyalty to a king. It was loyalty to their friend.
Chapter 33.
The Morrigie's army came into being centuries before any of the others had so much as set a cornerstone to the foundation of their realms. It was yet another thing the holy text emphasized, that the holy guardians, the fierce warriors who accompanied Morrigan on her trek through the wilderness, had unmatched strength and wills of steel bequeathed by the heavens themselves to ensure the survival of the chosen remnant. Aldred, who was to become her husband and the revered father of the kingdom, was one of those guardians. His warrior blood ran through all of us. The Citadel even had some of the Holy Guardian's swords displayed in the throne room, reminders of our greatness and the anointing of the gods. Throughout history, the Morrigie's army had remained great, and its soldiers were courageous and honorable. But as I watched the Dalbrech troops going through their exercises and training from my vantage point on the outpost wall, I was struck by their daunting precision. Their halberds were braced with formidable timing. Their shields were interlocked with the ease of a perfected dance. Confidence emanated from every meticulously orchestrated move. They practically glowed with intimidation. Their strength and discipline were like none I had ever seen. I understood why they believed in their power. But they couldn't see what I did. Their numbers. Even with an army 40,000 strong, they were no match for the terrible greatness of Venda. After Morrigan fell, Dalbrech would be next. My gaze rose to the wide expanse above the troops where a crescent moon shared the sky with the departing sun. Another day was gone, fewer still remaining. Time moved forward, circling, repeating, another devastation coiling like a poisonous serpent that had awakened, ready to strike. It was coming, and hidden forces in Morrigan were helping it in the most insidious way, from within, feeding it with power that would destroy us all. There had to be a way. Jezaliah, whose life will be sacrificed for the hope of saving yours. A different way. I wrestled with Venda's words. Sacrifice my life for mere hope. I would have preferred more than that, like certainty. But hope was at least something, and as unsure as it was all I had to offer Natia and so many more. Not even Wraith could take that away. Like the stories that Gaudrell had fed Morrigan, hope was nourishment for an empty belly. Jeb interrupted my thoughts, saying it was time to get ready for the party. Tavish and Orin stood several paces behind him, staring at me curiously. I looked out at the practice fields, and all the soldiers were gone. A handful of stars were already lighting the sky. Orin shifted, sniffing the air, but they all waited for me to make the first move to leave. The three of them had maintained a respectful distance all day, vanishing with skill, just as they had at the sanctum, but still always there, still always watching. It wasn't by their own volition they had taken on the task of escorts, as they claimed. I was certain it was by Rafe's orders. He was trying to shed his own embarrassment about having a parade of anonymous guards follow me. He knew I cared about these three. We had a history together, even if it was short. Nearly losing your lives together had a way of deepening bonds and lengthening time. I studied their faces. No, not guards. Their eyes were filled with the concern of friends, but no doubt if I saddled a horse to leave, they would become something else. They would stop me, even under the guise of friendship. I was still a prisoner. I gathered my skirts and got down from the wall. For the first time, I sniffed the scent of roasted meat in the air, and then remembered the lanterns being strung in the lower field earlier today, the canopy set for the head table, silk streamers draped between poles in anticipation of a party eagerly awaited by almost everyone. Jeb fell in by my side, and Tavish and Orin walked just behind us. Jeb picked at his shirt, smoothed the sleeve, pulled at his collar. "Say it, Jeb," I told him, "before you worry holes into your shirt." "His throne is being challenged," he blurted out, voiced like a plea for his friend. I heard Tavish and Orin groan behind us, obviously not pleased with Jeb's loose tongue. I rolled my eyes, unmoved. "Because of cabinet bickering? What else is new?"
"It's not the cabinet. One of his generals has begun proceedings to claim the throne."
A coup d'etat? My steps slowed. "So the Dalbrecht court has traitors, too?"
"The general isn't a traitor. It's within his rights. He's charging Prince Jackson with abdicating, which everyone knows is a false claim."
I stopped and faced Jeb. "His mere absence is interpreted as abdication?"
"Not by most, but it could be construed that way, especially with the general bandying even stronger terms around, like desertion. The prince has been gone for months."
I bristled. "Why didn't Rafe tell me?"
"Both colonels advised him not to tell anyone. Dissent breeds doubt."
"I wasn't just anyone. But maybe Rafe didn't want me to doubt him most of all." "Now that the general knows Rafe is alive, surely he'll stop those proceedings."
Jeb shook his head. "A general tasting power? He probably has an appetite now for the full-course meal. But Rafe has the overwhelming support of the troops. Their respect for him has only grown. It shouldn't take long to quell the challenge once he arrives back at the palace. But it's one more worry on his shoulders."
"And that's supposed to excuse his behavior of last night?"
"Not excuse," Tavish said from behind me. "Just to explain it and give you a fuller picture."
I spun around to face him. "Like the full picture you gave to Rafe when you caught Caden holding my hand. Maybe everyone in Dalbrecht needs to be sure of their information before they run off feeding it to others."
Tavish nodded, accepting his culpability. "I made a mistake, and I apologize. I only reported what I thought I saw, but news of the challenge comes directly from the cabinet. This is not a mistake."
"So Dalbrecht has a usurper. Is that supposed to sway me? Why are Dalbrecht's worries so much more important than Morrigan's? The Komazar rages with enough venom to make your general look like a whimpering kitten." My patience unraveled. The urgency, the long miles to Morrigan, the temptation to say yes when no still blared in my head, the needs of so many compared to the enormous lack within me. It all picked at every last shred of confidence I had until I felt like a frayed rope ready to snap, the last pull of weight coming from Rafe himself. If the person I loved the most in this world didn't believe in me, how would anyone else? My eyes stung, and I blinked back any show of weakness. "If anything, you'd think Rafe's situation would give him empathy and help him understand why I have to get back to Morrigan. But it doesn't seem he's given that a passing thought."
"It's not his head he's thinking with," Tavish said. "It's his heart. He fears for your safety."
His words stabbed into my tender underside. "I am not a thing to be protected, Tavish, any more than he is. My choices and my risks are my own." There was nothing he could say. I was right. They dropped me off at my tent. Percy and the other soldiers were already stationed there to take over.
"See you soon," Jeb said, offering a hesitant smile. "First dance."
"That will be reserved for the king," Tavish reminded him. Maybe not. Maybe there would be no dancing at all. At least not between Rafe and me. Kings and prisoners did not share dances. At least not in any world I wanted to be part of. I lay across my bed, stripped down to the soft comfort of my chemise, writing down the verses from the Song of Venda that had been ripped from the book. After so many years, I was finally returning her original words where they were meant to be. They squeezed onto the backside of the torn page. "Betrayed by her own, beaten and scorned. She will expose the wicked, for the dragon of many faces knows no boundaries. And though the wait may be long, the promise is great for the one named Jezaliah, whose life will be sacrificed for the hope of saving yours. I remembered every word she had spoken that day on the terrace, though at first I had only been preoccupied with the phrase, "whose life will be sacrificed." Now another phrase caught my attention. "She will expose the wicked." I fingered the burned edges of the book, and then the furious, jagged tear of the last page that attempted to rip the words from existence. I smiled. Someone hated me very much, or, maybe better, feared me, believing I would expose him or her. Fear, anger, desperation. That was what I saw in these burned edges and torn page. I would find a way to fuel that fear, because even though I knew desperation could make people dangerous, it also made them stupid. Exposing the highest players in this conspiracy was essential. If I fanned their fears, maybe they would choke and show their hands. With Malik on his way to tell them about me, I had already lost the advantage of surprise. They would be fortified and waiting. Now I'd have to turn that knowledge, at least in some small way, to my favor. I set the book aside and fluffed some pillows, leaning back against them, contemplating how I would go about this without exposing myself. I had to stay alive at least long enough to find out who might be conspiring with the Chancellor and Royal Scholar. Maybe one of the county lords? Their influence was limited, but if I was lucky, I might be there in time for when the winter conclave assembled. Or maybe it was others in the cabinet? The watch captain? The trade master? The field marshal? The timekeeper had always eyed me suspiciously, and he jealously guarded my father's schedule. Was it to keep him out of the way? I avoided the obvious. My father, who had posted the bounty for my arrest. He was many things, but he wasn't a traitor to his own people. He would have nothing to gain by conspiring with the Komazar. But was he an unwitting puppet? The solution seemed to be getting past the minions who surrounded his movements to speak directly to him. But that was a thorny problem, too. Would it be safe? I buried my fingers in the sable blanket at my side, bawling the softness into my fist. There was the matter of his anger to deal with. I remembered Walther's words. It's been almost a month, and he's still blustering around. Even the much-adored Prince Walther had to sneak behind my father's back to help me when he planted the false trail for trackers. The several months that had passed would not have diminished my father's anger. I had undermined his authority and humiliated him. Would he even listen to anything I had to say without a shred of evidence to support it? I was branded an enemy of Morgan, just like his nephew, whom he had hung. With only my word against a chancellor who had worked with devotion at his side for years, why would he believe me? Without evidence, the chancellor and royal scholar would turn my claims to make me look like a coward trying to wheedle out of my own culpability. The last time I had aimed even a mild insult at the Chancellor, my father became enraged and ordered me to my chamber. Would they use other, more permanent ways to silence me this time? My chest tightened with possibilities I couldn't untangle. Could I be wrong about everything? Wraith thought I was. My brothers were my only hope for inroads, but they were young like me. Only 19 and 21, and still low-ranking soldiers in the military. But if both of them pressed my father, maybe they could sway him to listen to me. And if not listen willingly, perhaps help me use more forceful ways to persuade him. Nothing felt beyond me right now, with so much at stake. A second round of music drifted up from the lower pasture. The party was well underway. It was beautiful, urgent music, the ringing conversation of a thousand strings, a chorus of rebuttals, satin-strummed gauntlets laid down again and again, the tone similar to our mandolins, but with a deeper, lustier reverberation. The farash, Jeb had called it when he came to pick me up. The battle dance. I had sent Jeb along without me, saying I wasn't quite ready. Once he was gone, I told my guards I wasn't going at all, and encouraged them to go and enjoy themselves, giving them my solemn oath I wouldn't leave my tent. I kissed two fingers and lifted them to the heavens as sincere evidence of my promise, then silently asked the gods to forgive my small lie. The godless oafs didn't budge, not even when I commented on how delicious the roasted meat smelled, and their eyes danced with visions of suckling pigs. I was nibbling on the pine nuts I had taken earlier when I heard the rattle of halberds outside my tent, and the curtain was swiped aside. It was Rafe, dressed in elegant full regalia, his black jacket draped with the gold braids of his station, his hair pulled back, and his cheekbones burnished with a day in the sun. His cobalt eyes flashed brightly beneath his dark brows, and waves of anger rolled off him. He stared at me like I had two heads. "What do you think you're doing?" he said between gritted teeth. The warmth that had leapt beneath my breastbone when he entered quickly shriveled to a cold rock in my stomach. I glanced at the bowl next to me and shrugged. "Eating nuts? Is that against the rules for prisoners?" His attention shifted to my scant attire, and his jaw grew impossibly more rigid. He turned, searching my room until his eyes landed on the midnight blue dress Viola had hung on the dressing screen. He strode across the tent in three steps, snatched it down, and threw it at me. It landed in a heap in my lap. His finger stabbed toward the tent door. "There are 400 soldiers down there, all waiting to meet you. You are a guest of honor. Unless you want all of their opinions of you to match Captain Haig's, I suggest you get dressed and make the small effort of an appearance." He stomped toward the door, then spun with one last order. "And you will not utter the word prisoner one time if you choose to attend." And then he was gone. I sat there, stunned. My first thought when he had walked in the door was that he looked like a god. I wasn't thinking that anymore. "If you choose." I grabbed my dagger and prayed for Adeline's forgiveness as I altered the dress she had lent me, and Viola's forgiveness, too, as I pried free a long piece of chain from her chainmail belt. I would attend the party just as he had asked, but I would attend as the person I was, not the one he wanted me to be.
Chapter 34, Rafe.
I slumped against the paddock rail where the torchlights from the party didn't reach and stared at the ground. Quiet footsteps stopped near me. I didn't look up, didn't speak. It seemed every time I opened my mouth, I said stupid things. How was I going to lead an entire kingdom if I couldn't even sway Leah without losing my temper? "She's coming?" I shook my head, closing my eyes. "I don't know. Probably not after..." I didn't finish. Sven could put it together without my rehashing every detail. I didn't want to remember everything I'd said. It was getting me nowhere. I didn't know what to do. "She's still set on going back?" I nodded. Every time I thought about it, fear gripped me. More footsteps. Tavish and Jeb came up on my other side and leaned on the rail beside me. Jeb offered me a mug of ale. I took it and set it on the post, not feeling thirsty. "I wouldn't let her go back either," Tavish finally said. "We understand your position, if it helps." Jeb mumbled agreement. It didn't help. It didn't matter how many agreed with me if Leah didn't. As sure as I was that I couldn't let her go, she was certain she had to leave. I thought about when I'd found her on the riverbank, half dead, and all the hours I carried her through the snow, all the times I pressed my lips to hers to make sure she was still breathing, all the steps and miles where I thought, if only I had answered her note, if only I had honored her simple request. But this time, it wasn't a simple request. This time it was different. She wanted to head straight into danger, and she expected to do it with Caden. I grabbed the mug of ale and swallowed it dry, slamming it back down on the post. "You two are at cross purposes," Sven said. He leaned back against the paddock rail, studying me. "What was it about her that caught your attention in the first place?" I shook my head. What difference did it make? "I don't know." I wiped my mouth with my sleeve. "There must have been something." Something. I thought about when I had walked into the tavern. Maybe it was the first time I saw her, and I... A memory surfaced. No, it was long before that. Before I ever laid eyes on her. The note. The gall. A voice demanding to be heard. The same things that angered me now had intrigued me back then. But even that wasn't what had captured my imagination. It was the day she had left me at the altar. The day a 17-year-old girl had been brave enough to thumb her nose at both my kingdom and her own. A refusal of epic proportions because she believed in and wanted something else. That was what had first captivated me. It was her bravery. I looked up at Sven. He stared at me as if he could see the unsaid words behind my eyes. As if I were a horse he had just forced to drink from a dirty trough of my own making. "It doesn't matter." I snatched the empty mug from the post and walked back to the party, feeling his scrutiny on my back. She was dancing with Captain Azia when I returned to the head table, smiling and enjoying his company. He clearly enjoyed hers, too. Next, she danced with a pledge who was no more than 15. He was unable to hide his infatuation and had a ridiculous smile pasted on his face. And then there was another soldier, and another. I saw a few on the perimeter of the dance area staring at her bare shoulder, her kavah in plain view. She had cut away a sleeve and part of one shoulder on her dress to expose it, undoubtedly a message for me. The Moragese vine tangled around the Dalbrech claw, holding it back. How differently I saw the kavah now. And then I spotted the bones. My fingers curled into my palms. I thought she had left the miserable practice behind us in Venda. Where she had gotten so many bones, I didn't know, but against her fine blue velvet gown, a long chain of them dangled, swinging through the air as she danced like a disjointed skeleton. She avoided my gaze, but I knew she was aware of my presence. Whenever she paused between dances, she fingered the monstrosity hanging at her side and smiled like it was as precious as a jeweled belt of gold mail. Another round of the farrash began, and I watched her dancing with Orin, stamping her foot toward him, retreating back. They circled and clapped their hands high over their heads, and then slapped them together, the sound ringing through the field, echoing off the high walls. Orin laughed, oblivious to my stare or her maneuvers, and I marveled at how he lived so fully in the moment. Whether it was dancing, cooking, or pulling back his arrow for the kill, only the moment mattered. Maybe that was why he was such a skilled archer and a fearless one. I didn't have the luxury of living only in a single moment. I had to live in 100 fractured moments that held our futures in the balance. I had a new understanding of my father, my mother too, and the decisions they had to make, sometimes compromising something they wanted for the greater good of something else. The dancers sidestepped to the right, a new partner circled back from the opposite end, and I saw Leah matched with Caden. I had been so focused on her, I hadn't even noticed him farther down in the line of dancers. Their hands clapped overhead, and when they circled, I saw words pass between them. Only words. She had spoken with Oren, too, but this time the unheard words burned through me. "Your Majesty?" Vyla caught me by surprise. I sat up from my slouched position. She curtsied, her brown cheeks blushing warmer, then she held her hand out to me. "You haven't danced all night. Do me the honor." I took her hand, trying to shake my flustered state, and stood. "I'm sorry, I've been occupied, I know." Instead of me escorting her to the dance floor, she led the way, and instead of going to the end of the line, she squeezed in to Leah's right. I reluctantly took my place opposite her, realizing how easily she had duped me. I raised a questioning brow, and she smiled, stamping toward me to begin our dance. I stamped back. We circled, we clapped, and it seemed it was only seconds before it was time to move to the right, to a new partner. Leah and I stood opposite each other. She dipped her chin in cursory acknowledgement. I did the same. The rest of the dancers were already moving toward one another. We worked to catch up. She stamped forward, and I retreated. When it was my turn to move toward her, she didn't retreat. "Tired?" I asked. "Never. I'm simply not fond of that step." We circled, my back brushing hers. "Thank you for coming," I said over my shoulder. She snorted. I reminded myself not to speak. At our last overhead clap, just as our hands touched, the music immediately changed to the Amara, the midnight dance of lovers. Someone was conspiring with Vyla. My hand squeezed around Leah's, slowly lowering it, bringing it to my side. My other hand circled her waist, and I pulled her close, as the dance dictated. I felt the stiffness of her back, but kept my hold firm. I breathed in the scent of her hair and felt the softness of her fingers between mine. "I don't know this dance," she whispered. "Let me show you." I tucked my chin near her temple and pulled her hips close to mine as I leaned her back, then swept her to the side, bringing her upright as we circled around. The muscles in her back loosened, and she relaxed in my arms. The night suddenly seemed darker, the music more distant, and though the air was cool, her skin was hot against mine. I searched for something to say, something that wouldn't take our conversation to places I didn't want to go. "Leah," I whispered against her cheek. It was all I could utter, even though other words crowded my mind. I wanted to tell her about Dalbrick, its beauty and wonders, the people who would love and welcome her, all the things she would marvel at. But I knew, no matter what I said, it would lead her back to Morrigan, and for me, it would lead back to the traitors and noose she would face there. The music slowed, and she lifted her head from my shoulder. Only shallow breaths separated our lips for a long-drawn moment. But then her back tightened again, and I knew it was far more than a breath that lay between us. We stepped apart, and her eyes searched mine. "You never intended to take me back to Morrigan, did you?" she asked. There were no more creative dodges left in me. "No. Even before you knew that your parents were dead, before you knew any of your troubles back home. I was trying to keep you alive, Leah. I said what I thought you needed to hear at the time. I was trying to give you hope. I have hope, Rafe," I've had it all along. I never needed false hope from you. Her expression betrayed no emotion, except for the glisten in her eyes. But that was enough to hollow me out. She turned and walked away, the bones jingling at her hip, the claw and the vine on her shoulder glaring back at me.
Chapter 35, Caden.
I was in the middle of ruins, turning my head, listening. Something was there. They were coming. A high-pitched howl split the air, but I couldn't move. And then the world spun, and I was flying through the air, tripping, stumbling. The fabric of my shirt cut into my neck as someone balled it into their fists. This part was real, not a dream. I instinctively grabbed for my knife, but of course it wasn't there. My eyes adjusted to the darkness. It was Rafe. He was dragging me from my bed toward the door. He threw me out of the barracks, then slammed me up against the wall, the night watch stepping aside, ready to let him tear me to pieces. Even in the darkness, his face glowed with rage. "So help me, if you so much as lay a hand on her, if you drag her back to that godforsaken kingdom, if you do anything." "Are you mad?" I asked. "It's the middle of the night." The fury in his eyes made no sense. I had done nothing. "I've never harmed her. I would never..." "We leave an hour past dawn. Be ready," he said between clenched teeth. There was ale on his breath, but he wasn't drunk. His eyes were wild and bright, like a wounded animal. "You woke me to tell me that? I already knew when we were leaving." He glared at me, freeing my shirt from his grip, giving me one last shove against the wall. "Well, now you know again." He walked away, and I got my bearings. The rest of the camp was silent, asleep in their quarters, and for a brief moment, I wondered if he had a walking nightmare. It wasn't just anger I had seen in his expression. There was fear, too. Grizz and Eben poked their heads out the door, their eyes still full of sleep, and the night watch stepped forward. Eben was still under close watch.
"What was that all about?"
Grizz grumbled. "Go back to bed," I said. I pushed Eben's shoulder, and he went back in. Grizz and I followed, but I couldn't get to sleep, trying to puzzle out what had prompted Rafe's attack. "If you do anything..." What did he think I was going to do with 200 soldiers surrounding us on our way to Dalbrek? I was skilled, maybe even foolhardy at times, but I wasn't stupid, especially knowing they kept a suspicious watch on me, too. I rubbed my jaw. Somewhere along the way, when he dragged me from my bed, he must have planted his fist in my face. Dawn was just lighting the eastern horizon. Mist in the distance hovered close to the ground in soft layers like a downy blanket. It made the morning even quieter. The only sound was my boots swishing against the dew-covered grass. I had managed to elude my escorts, at least temporarily. This was not a quest for which I wanted company. I reached the end of the merchant wagons near the back wall of the outpost and spotted the charred Carvaches and Natia. Her eyes met mine, and she drew a knife, and I knew she meant to use it. I stared at her, not sure she was even the same person. She'd gone from a soft-spoken girl with an eager smile who used to weave presents for me to a fierce young woman I didn't know. "I'm going in to see Dehara. Step aside," I told her.
"She doesn't want to see you. No one wants to see you."
She lunged at me, the knife blindly slicing the air, and I jumped back. She came at me again.
"You little..."
On her next lunge, I grabbed her wrist, spinning her around so the knife was at her own throat. With my other arm, I held her tight against my chest so she couldn't move.